Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your deeply mangled comeback of pop music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Trying to keep control, pressure's taking its toll, stuck in the middle zone, I just want you alone. My guessing game is strong, way too real to be wrong. Caught up in your show, yeah, at least now I know. It wasn't love, it was a perfect illusion. Mistaken for love, it wasn't love. If you're still listening after those 30 seconds, that was Lady Gaga's Perfect Illusion, a song that has been released recently to vast distaste in the world. You got people out here posting their Slack conversations about how troubling this record is. And, you know, never one to overlook a good gimmick. I've convened the brain trust of the New York Times pop music squad to talk about Lady Gaga and the rest of what is happening with fall. Let's talk about who's here with us. I have Karen Gans. Karen Gans is our pop music editor. What's up, Karen?
Hi, John.
How's your mood today?
I'm feeling good.
I hope that's going to last. I have John Perellis, chief pop music editor of the New York Times.
Hey, John.
Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter.
I'm here.
How's your emotions right now?
Feeling all right.
Yeah.
This fall preview looks beautiful.
Doesn't it, though?
Pick it up on Sunday.
Don't you think a great starting point would to be talk to Karen Gans about Lady Gaga?
Yeah, tell us about Lady Gaga.
Yeah, let's talk about Lady Gaga. So Perfect Illusion is a song. Let's start with that.
Ostensibly.
I can put a firm period at the end of that sentence. It is a song.
It's a song.
It also might be like six songs, all sort of multi-tracked into one. This is sort of unpleasant, this record, I believe. Karen, you are a noted Gagologist.
I am.
Let's talk about where this song places in the Gaga legacy. What is it accomplishing that maybe has or has not been accomplished before by her?
This was sort of a critical Gaga moment because Art Pop did not do exactly what she wanted it to do. It was sort of like a grand, glittery experiment.
Great parties.
Giant Coons.
Shouts to everybody who are at those parties.
Yeah.
They're very beautifully dressed people at those parties.
But I think ultimately the album was not a huge success. So she went away.
Aesthetically or financially?
I think both.
Yes.
Yeah.
True story.
She acted on American Horror Story.
Mm-hmm.
She's actually had a great break, really.
She did, yes.
Like, yeah. Cheek to cheek.
She's handled things very well. She had an excellent
Sound of Music
duet
medley.
Record. Yes. So everyone was just wondering what is going to be the sound of this record. And, you know, based off this song, because we really haven't heard anything else, she hasn't said much else, it sounds like it's a return to what she sees as like a rock pop vibe.
Mm-hmm.
However, the song is not really doing what she wants it to do.
It's not rocking, it's not popping. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting how that works. I don't like to sort of overly go at artists based on a first single, especially when they have a whole body of work that's kind of, you know, just right around the corner, because you don't want to be like woefully out of step.
I'm sensing a however.
However,
yeah.
I do think it's important to note that making songs that sound maybe somewhat fundamentally incorrect has long been key to Lady Gaga's success. And I feel like there are moments earlier in her career where the initial sting of a song felt false or bad.
When she's good, she zigs where people have zagged.
Yes.
This is a song that after I listened to twice, which I think was probably the minimum amount of times I was allowed to listen to this and talked about it on the podcast today,
mm-hmm.
By the end of the second listen, I thought there's a version of American History that embraces this song. I don't think it's very good, but I think, I don't know, the build in like the third quarter of it, there was something about it that felt very convincing.
Are you saying it's a grower?
I'm not
Are we going to all love it in a month?
I'm not saying it's a grower. I do not believe that. But I
was
believe
not
it
expecting
could be,
this. I have to be honest.
I believe it could be effective, especially when I believe Interscope does what it's going to do, which is like make Kygo remix it or something.
Right.
Like they're going to hire some like, you know, Norwegian, Indonesian 12-year-old to make a SoundCloud remix of it.
That's
and
possible.
That's how it's going to end.
But I feel like there is something fundamentally wrong with the chorus in that it doesn't go where it's supposed to go. It obviously it sounds like it wants to open up,
mm-hmm.
and but the I'm making a hand gesture that nobody can see on the podcast right now, but it's very constrained, not that kind. I'm just indicating a very small amount of space, which is the amount of space where the melody is in the song. And
let the record reflect that Karen Gans is holding her hands approximately the width of a bocce ball.
Yeah.
That's true. Right. Yes, yeah. And then the production sounds very, you know, clenched and constipated as well. It just mm-hmm. is very overproduced. It's just a little too much. It just sounds
and
wrong.
We have like a dream team, a pop dream team behind this, right? Like
yes.
On production, we have Mark Ronson.
We have
Blood Pop.
Tame Impala's Kevin Parker, an excellent songwriter.
The new pop go-to indie guy.
The new Greg Kirsten.
It's,
congrats. You know, so hey, Kevin, congrats.
On paper, this team seems like they're going to create a smash. And yet, is it just the wrong moment? Are we not ready for this rock revival?
I'm ready.
On the pop charts? We know you're ready.
Right. I'm ready. Yeah, I'm ready.
It wasn't the one.
But do you get the sense that there are like three or four dominant melodic ideas at war on this song?
Yes.
Like, that's ultimately the thing, is like, we have this dream team, each of whom apparently like whispered to their people like, hey, I'm going to put this thing in the song.
Yeah.
And it's like everybody said that, not didn't tell anybody else. And then someone at the end when they did the mix was like, I'll just leave this all in.
And then they said, key change. Yeah.
So anyway, Lady Gaga's got a record coming out.
So she does.
What do we know about it?
We don't know too much. We know that it's coming out in October. Mm-hmm. We know that the aforementioned people have worked on it. We don't know the name.
Is it possible that this single is literally just a medley of four songs that are on the record? Is that a possibility? It's like, what do they used to call it? Like a master mix?
Yeah.
Is this like the Lady Gaga master mix?
I'll suggest that to the label, but I don't think that's true. Yeah, we don't know too much else. I mean, but I have to say, this is sort of a scary first taste.
So Joe, like, who are some of these people you've been Googling working on the Lady Gaga record?
So we've got Beck, Father John Misty. We've got Florence.
Who are not the same person, for the record.
Different.
Yes. Florence.
Josh Homme apparently played guitar on Perfect Illusion. Okay. You know, she's got the big guns out. She wants this to be a Gaga-sized blockbuster. This isn't cheek to cheek.
She has the white all-stars.
Yeah,
true story.
No Diplo yet.
Not yet. Never too late.
Let's get him a remix. Perfect Illusion.
She is like conservative with the electronics. You know, she sticks to the people that she knew. Like, Red One is not the most adventurous producer. He's good, but...
Mm-hmm.
And so do you have any hopes for this album to be...
don't pin this all on me.
Karen, as the big Gaga fan in the room.
Well, I was so let down by the Britney record. That's a whole other
topic. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But, I mean, it did come out in the fall. It will be better than the Britney record.
Wow, okay. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
2016 has been strange because almost everyone who is a pop centrist... has already released an album, and typically in surprise fashion. So you have Beyonce, you have Rihanna, you have Drake, you have Kanye. Yep. All of these people have dropped huge, huge records.
And they're ambushes.
They're ambushes, and they're all still in some form or fashion part of the conversation.
They
whether
are.
On radio or on streaming or on tour, they have defined this year. And that's a bit of a change because we've all been writing for a long time. And I remember a day where September, October, November was reliably when all the big gunners
came.
Well,
beyond that, they save giant releases for November for Christmas shopping, for Black Friday. That's mm-hmm. like the Adele and Rihanna were always November releases.
And Adele is still there.
Yes.
Yeah, she's going to be your Christmas gift every year for the next 5 years.
But do you think that was saving it for Black Friday, or do you think that was, this is the very furthest I can push my deadline?
Ooh. That's fair. Yeah.
But whatever
But I think that was the strategy. Like, you know, every label had like the giant tentpole fourth quarter release that was going to save them, you know, save their grosses or whatever.
Because obviously, I mean, you think about how labels would sort of fail to release a lot of records in January, February, March. So, and I know a lot of these labels with their contracts with their distribution companies or their parent companies, they're mandated to release a certain number of albums in a given time, in a given fiscal year or in a given 12-month period. So what you ended up having was a lot of stuff that was big that was saved towards the end of the year, and also some stuff that just kind of got dumped where it's like, oh no, we've got to put two more records out in 2012, so things get dumped in November. I wonder how that changes our jobs a little bit, because I notice that whereas you could reliably be on low alert for the first 3 months of the year, you know, up until maybe two, three years ago, now that's not at all the case. You're on high alert sort of constantly. And also, you can't really preview anymore. Like, there, the two things about fall preview that are sort of increasingly false is that fall is the most relevant release season, which is not the case. And preview is something that you can do accurately, which is not the case because the biggest stars, Taylor, are hiding their products. Joe?
I think we'll have some big releases.
You got some bangers?
In store. You know, I think even if we're not hearing about them in advance, like, there are going to be more albums. You know, we have rumors of Taylor, as mm-hmm. you said. Gigi said she's back in the studio.
Yeah, Gigi.
This is Jay and Beyonce, long rumored duets album. Mm-hmm. there
DM
that
us.
May exist.
B Legion.
Maybe
DM me.
Frank Ocean has another album.
maybe Katy Perry.
No.
Oh Katy Perry might have
Katy
an album.
Perry. You know, there are still these names kicking around. But yes, in terms of looking at the calendar and knowing this is when the summer albums come, this is when the big rap album comes, this is when the Jay-Z album comes, mm-hmm. every fourth quarter, whatever. That's a thing of the past.
Does that feel like more destabilizing to you, JP?
Completely. I mean, we're all sitting there waiting for like the ambush release that we're going to have to write about in 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is anxiety land.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, the fall preview, it's I don't know what I'm going to be doing in November yet.
Right.
You used to have at least a clue.
Yeah, that's something if you notice, if you look at our fall preview sections historically over the last, say, 5 or 10 years, I felt like, and you maybe can correct me on this, but I feel like the distribution across months was pretty equitable, say like in 2007 or 2008, and now the distribution across months is very, very front-loaded towards September and October, and after November 1, it's kind of like Kanye shrug.
I think
like,
there's 2 items in December this year, maybe 3.
Right, and we've had, in the past, you know, we've had a dozen or whatever, yeah. You know. Let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's coming up that we're excited about. JP, there's something that you want to kick off with?
2 things, or let's just kick off with one. There's this teenage songwriter from England named Billy Martin, mm-hmm. who is just wonderful. I mean, I don't know. She's one of these old souls in a young body
mm-hmm.
songwriters. She's folky. She reminds me a little of Laura Marling, who I also love.
Sure.
She's just a really smart, quiet, profound songwriter that I'm really looking forward. I mean, the album's good, and I want to see her play. I'm really excited to know more about her.
So let's listen to a little bit of Billy Martin, Lionhearted.
I've never been too bold. Keeping in the quiet and shade, I could run away with all my time. Wouldn't it feel the same? Oh, this is lonely territory. I've got ahead.
So that was Billy Martin, Lionhearted. Something I feel like we've been seeing a lot of, and I feel like, Joe, you and I have both written a little bit about this, are sort of semi-rebellious, young female pop influence, but not straight pop singers.
There's a lot of them right
now. It's a real thing happening right now. And it feels like kind of a reaction to a Katy Perry and a reaction to a Taylor Swift.
And maybe started with Lorde. Is that where we trace
it
to?
Yeah, I feel like Lorde is patient zero on that one. Someone who really jumps out at me along those lines and thinking about her, especially in context of this Billy Martin that JP was just talking about, is Angelica Garcia. Angelica Garcia is a young sort of country rock into blues singer-songwriter who has a single out called Orange Flower, which is kind of this wry, funny thing about going out on dates with a guy and not being able to tell if he likes her or if he likes her as a friend or if he likes her as more than a friend.
What's the metaphor?
It's not a yellow flower and it's not a red flower.
Ah,
it's in between.
Got you.
There you go. What's the metaphor? A new podcast with Joe Pasquarelli.
I haven't heard the song. I'm excited to
enough.
Listen.
Fair point.
Well, is she rootsy? I mean, is she country?
Yes. She's not a country singer. I'm loath to use this term because it's not a real thing, but she is an Americana singer in the sense that her influence points are old-timey country, sort of Delta blues, a little bit of bluegrass, a little bit of country rock in a sort of like 70s sense.
So is she recording in Nashville?
She recorded with a Nashville producer. She's not from Nashville. She's actually originally from the east side of Los Angeles. Her mom was a mariachi singer and her stepfather was a music executive who worked with Los Lobos and Dwight Yoakam and folks and a bunch of songwriters kind of in that space.
Sounds like Americana to me, John.
But that's like not a real thing. That's like, sure, but that's like, I mean, I don't know. That's not, do you think Americana is real? Just because there's a conference for it doesn't make it real. Shouts to all our friends at the Americana Conference, though. I hope you guys are having a killer year this year.
It's their 15th year. They're actually a great lineup.
JP knows.
JP stunted on me with that. Anyway, she very much to me fits in with this movement that we've been talking about. Like, I'm not sure if it's conscious or unconscious, but she's someone who clearly knows how to write a really good pop song, but also I feel like her songs are kind of like fundamentally acts of resistance.
He gave me an orange flower. What in the hell does that mean? Am I halfway to red and halfway to yellow? Am I his mother or his lover? Someone in the middle. Oh.
Okay, who's got next? Josie, what do you got?
I did a little breakout feature for the fall preview on Danny Brown, who's coming back with his first album in 3 years.
The excellently voiced Danny Brown.
Yes. Excellent hair, excellent teeth, excellent voice.
True story.
He's just a real character, and I think he sort of carved out this weird niche for himself after Triple X and Old, which he followed up pretty quickly after. He was bringing in his, you know, Detroit dance music background, mm-hmm. where he's from, and then sort of turned that into, you know, a very lucrative EDM crossover moment.
Which is not, you know, Danny Brown. The thing that I've always noticed about Danny Brown, especially in interviews, is he is genuinely a student. Like, he really is a historian. He
yes.
really takes seriously the history of rapping as like a social and aesthetic act. I will say it's strange for me to hear him on records like that.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, this is basically you're playing the role, but do you have bars?
And I think he sort of realized that, because one thing he said to me was, you know, those EDM songs on Old made me the most money. That he was like, that's when I bought a house. Like, that, you know, that was a commercial decision. Mm-hmm. But he sees this new album, Atrocity Exhibition, named for a Joy Division song.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think speaks to
his emotional state.
Yes, true. But he sees this as more of a picking up where Triple X left off, which I feel was more, it was deeper considered historical document, as opposed to Old, which seemed like him capitalizing on a moment.
Yeah.
So what he did was he took these 3 years, he signed to Warp, got himself a bigger budget. You know, he studied, he said, the Talking Heads, and like, you know, watching a lot of music documentaries and reading, and mm-hmm. and he came back with this sort of very dark, sort of worrying album where
Twisted Fantasy kind of thing.
Yeah, where he's long sort of rapped about drugs as like a numbing thing, mm-hmm. and but it's often understood to be party music,
mm-hmm.
and he always has this problem where he's singing songs about his depression and about how he's, you know, self-medicating,
mm-hmm.
and kids think it's about, you know, getting messed up
having
on the weekends.
Having a grand old time.
So this time he took it even further, and he's more explicit in saying, you know, these are the things that I do to get out of my own head, and the music sort of matches the subject matter in this case. So it's darker. There are weird soul and rock samples, and it's very full. It's sort of haunting. It's like you go through this journey with him. He described it as like a bender, basically.
Is it exuberant? Because like a thing about Danny Brown that's always interesting is no matter how kind of like scraped up the subject matter is, because of his vocal tone and also the kind of pitch and rhythms that
yeah.
he raps in, there's an exuberance that kind of naturally comes out. Is that something that he tempers?
There's some of that. I mean, he is using his high-pitched voice. You know, mm-hmm. he'll often switch between the sort of his quote-unquote normal voice, which is deeper, and he does that for more introspective songs. And then he has his sort of yap, his like squeal that he's known for, which he does on the more party-ish tracks,
mm-hmm.
and he's mostly in that higher register on this album, but it doesn't come across as music you want to dance to or even, you know, smoke or drink to. It's
mm-hmm.
it's uglier in a way,
mm-hmm.
Which
it's more
I think
private.
Works. Yeah, there's something, there's more interior, I think, on this album, and he seems to be very proud of it in a way that I think, you know, an artist who gets really big and is sort of taking every opportunity afforded to them. And then he, you know, he retreated and he came back to Detroit and he sort of started from scratch, and he came up with this thing that I think is the most representative of his character as an artist thus far in his career.
Karen Gans, what else you got?
I was going to mention that there's a lot of quote-unquote rock, you know, however you define it, records coming out this fall, which is actually a little strange.
Can you explain to our listeners what rock
is? I'm not going to define it.
Are you sure? Because I feel like the fans might not know.
There's some records with guitars coming out this fall.
You're talking about the Pretty Reckless.
I am, actually, but...
we should. Let's talk about the Pretty Reckless.
I wasn't, but we can go there.
Okay,
and then
that
we can circle
joke.
Back.
Yeah. No, but we will come back to
I was
going
to mention, I mean, there's a Phish record, there's a Bob Weir record. There's a Van Morrison record. Mm-hmm. There's a Kings of Leon record, Metallica. But the spinner was going to stop on Green Day for me.
Sure.
Because that's the one that I heard and that I actually like. It's a good Green Day record.
So talk a little bit about the Green Day record, because it's not
an opera.
It's not Hamilton.
It's not.
Yeah.
They could have gone in that direction.
Punkleton?
You could have seen
Hamilpunk?
They could have doubled down.
Hamilpunk,
I
think.
I was expecting it.
That's kind of a genre. Hamilpunk is kind of a good genre name. Like for people who like do like Civil War reenact.
Titus Andronicus?
Hey! Yeah. That's Joe Coscarelli! Get out, boy, raise!
That's pretty good. there's a bonus in your future.
Yeah.
No, they hunkered down in Oakland. They went to the studio. They didn't tell anyone. They didn't tell the label. They just like went to their friend's studio and started recording. And it sounds more like classic Green Day, mm-hmm. if you will. It's just like fast punk songs.
Right.
There's like one or two that hinge, you know, they're a little more
like
theatrical.
Classic Green Day, like that last Blink record was classic Blink, like same thing.
Oh.
Can't be classic Blink without Tom. We already did this podcast.
True.
That's true. It's true. I should have been on that one. Yeah. Classic, like Kerplunk, like, you know, faster, actually punk songs, you know, they're angry. He started that single that came out a couple of weeks ago, Bang Bang, was written from the perspective of like a shooter. And when he wrote it, it was like 50 mass shootings ago. Like he can't get over the fact that the song is so relevant now. Mm-hmm. But it's a strong record. Mm-hmm. I feel good about Green Day.
And of the other, all the other rock records you named are by veterans of one stripe or another. Whether it's Kings of Leon, who are 10-year veterans, or Bob Weir, who's a 100-year veteran. You know.
I mean, there are some good indie rock albums coming out too.
Yeah,
well,
sure.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, but let's talk a little bit about, like, rock of a next generation. Like, I don't know, like, maybe a band that's super passionate and exciting. Like, I don't know, maybe, like, the Pretty Reckless.
Let's talk about the Pretty Reckless.
I'm so glad you asked. Yeah. I think that's, like, a great opportunity to talk about the Pretty Reckless. Like, I just, like, was waking up today hoping for this.
What is the one thing that everybody knows about the Pretty Reckless?
That I love them?
Besides that.
Okay, the second thing that everybody knows about the Pretty Reckless is that the front woman is Taylor Momsen, who is Jenny on Gossip Girl.
And what are some things that people should know about the Pretty Reckless?
That they shred.
I'm really spoon-feeding him here.
Oh, yeah. Pretty Reckless. Okay, what you need to know about the Pretty Reckless is they have not released a bad album to date. I've only seen them live, unfortunately, on Warped Tour, and this was like very early in their career.
Describe the sound of the Pretty Reckless.
Like that.
Well, sort of like you also wonder how she can like sing through a whole set because she's tearing up her voice.
It's a thing that felt very sticky, say like what, 6 years ago?
Yeah,
it felt
when
very
she was sticky. A teen actress.
Yeah, and then she really committed to the sort of Lita Ford-like light look, mm-hmm. and then is just kind of gone with that. And thus far, I feel like unerringly, if we're just going to, you know, there was a year, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, where like a Pretty Reckless record almost made my top 10. Like almost.
But it's also very commercially successful.
This is, okay, we're going to have a whole separate Pretty Reckless conversation down the line. But the baffling thing about the Pretty Reckless is they remain successful in a climate where bands like that don't do very well.
Correct.
Like, well, speaking of bands that haven't announced albums, I would very much like Paramore to come
seriously
and swoop down on
free
that
Paramore.
Pretty Reckless release.
Free Paramore.
I know we can fit both. There's a room for
That's
both
true.
Of them in this world.
That's right, Joe.
But Team Paramore.
You can call it Paramore, but you know it's just Haley right now.
The old guy's back. The band's back together.
Is it?
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
They're recording.
You saw it on a live journal somewhere? Like, which?
Yeah, the original guitar player has returned to Paramore, I believe.
I mean, I think that's completely immaterial.
I think so,
Yeah, it's totally immaterial.
I think that's great news.
Yeah, I'm very excited. But again, it doesn't take anything away from my favorite band and yours, The Pretty Reckless. So in less important records than
outside
the
of the rock revival.
Yeah, outside of Pretty Reckless records, there are other, I suppose, pretty good records that are coming out. So, but as we are kicking out of this week's podcast, we're going to run around the table one time and talk a little bit about some other records we're excited about. C. Gans, what do you got?
Well, the lead of our entire package is actually a big profile on Norah Jones.
Sorry, read that package.
Nate Chinnan, who's not here right now, so I'm going to represent for him.
That's right. He is in, can we say where he is?
I think we can.
He's in an undisclosed.
Nate's overseas.
It's an undisclosed
That's
location.
All you need to know. This Nora record is it's sort of a big deal because it's sort of it's a return to jazz. You know, she was sort of a jazz dropout is how she describes it. You know, she got very famous off her first record. She kind of meandered, and now she's back and she's playing with like very intensely important jazz people like Wayne Shorter and Brian Blade. She debuted it at the Newport Jazz Festival. This is the first time she's ever played the Newport Jazz Festival.
Oh, is that true? She never played Newport Jazz
Festival? She never played. Huh. And as Nate points out in his story, it's actually like I think it's the first time in more than 15 years it sold out the day that she played.
There's a Nora Jones single that's out, or that's just out.
There, this is called Flip Side. The album is called Daybreaks. Mm-hmm. And is absolutely excellent.
Hard times, fine lines.
JP, what do you got?
Well, let's talk about Bon Iver, who's doing his. John was actually not auto-tuned there.
No, that's my true voice. But A&Rs, get at me.
This is his difficult third album.
Well, I thought he made a difficult second
yeah,
album.
Yeah,
well, true. I mean, he you know, since he's prolifically recorded before he was Bon Iver, the people who liked him because he was so mellow. The singles that are out already, some of them do kick you in the teeth. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful record. I've heard the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to sort of figuring out what it's all about.
Does it feel ragey to you?
Rage?
Ragey.
Against the Machine?
No. I've never heard of that band. No, ragey. Like, is it angry?
No.
Okay, what is it?
I'd say it's more contemplative. I'd say it's less about interpersonal relationships and more about metaphysics. But that's just the first couple of listens.
Although there is a name drop of the Ace Hotel in one of the songs.
I definitely caught that.
There you go.
And I feel like, I mean, with Justin Vernon, nothing is imprecise. So
it's a concept album about boutique hotels.
I think you have to read the statement.
It's a boutique hotel about concept albums.
Yeah, read the statement that came with the initial release. That'll help illuminate it, or maybe
we'll,
not.
We'll provide a link to that on nytimes.com. Joe Coscarelli.
I'm looking forward to this Tove Lo album.
Yeah, you are.
Tove Lo, I feel like, is an accidental pop star.
And a cool girl.
So her single now, Cool Girl, is an homage to Gone Girl, to the famous Cool Girl monologue in Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. But she just has this sort of slacker vibe. She sort of fits in this pop outsider women that we discussed. But she made this first album, which is all about getting stoned and crying and eating snacks. And for some reason, it had all these radio hits on it. And they're tight,
fair,
you know, they're tight songs.
And that's a pretty relatable setting.
Sure, sure. Yeah. But it's not what you'd expect. It's not as, like, polished as some of the other solo women who get to grace the Z100 airwaves. Yeah, she has a little bit of an edge to her. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cool that she sort of elevated beyond what was expected of her. And now I think she'll, you know, she has the budget and she has the push to go again.
Is it not going to ruin her?
It could.
But she has the soul of like kind of like a warehouse punk kid.
Yeah.
And she survived that Nick Jonas collaboration.
That's true. And she sounds good on that song. Yeah. It's not a great song, but I think she, you know, she saved it even.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll close out with another woman who is sort of loosely fitting into this bigger narrative that's happening in pop, and that's Daya. Daya, unfortunately, was delivered to us initially, well, not initially, but most prominently via a Chainsmokers collaboration.
That's a great song.
It is. It is a great song. I'm just, unfortunately, once you've touched one of the Chainsmokers, you are infected for life.
You turn to dust.
Yeah, it's actually in the booklet. If you download it on iTunes, it's in the booklet. That song is called "Don't Let Me Down," and it is an excellent song, very much in spite of the Chainsmokers.
And a huge hit,
massive hit,
inescapable.
Not as massive, unfortunately, as the Halsey record, but I think way better than that Halsey record. And Daya has her own release. I believe it's an EP. That is coming out, and there is a single from it that is called Sit Still, Look Pretty, that I think is pretty good. And to me, I think a real struggle that I think we're seeing now with quote-unquote EDM pop is it's sort of birthing this class of anonymous singers. And this is something that was always true in sort of the club pop in the 90s, where the singers would basically, the accent pieces and the producers were getting shine. That went away, and now it's coming back in the last year or two. Daya, I think, might actually have the legs to outrun that. So as we're going out, let's listen to Sit Still, Look Pretty by Daya. But I don't want to be the puppet that you're playing on a string. This queen don't need a king. Oh, I don't know what you've been told, but this guy right here's gonna rule the world. Yeah, that is what I'm gonna be, because I wanna be. No, I don't wanna sit still, look pretty. You get up. Thanks for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thanks to my guests, Karen Gans, John Perellis, Joe Coscarelli. You can read everything we've ever said about fall 2016 music at nytimes.com/music. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Hell, email us your thoughts at podcast@nytimes.com. Our producers are Pedro Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we will be back next week.